You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Today, Sasha Konstantichuk, who is a Berkman Fellow, and he is a postdoc at UC Annenberg, and he's just been appointed to Assistant Professor of Civic Media at MIT in the Comparative Media Studies program, which is really exciting that he'll be here in Cambridge next year. He's going to share with us a presentation on transmedia mobilization, which is 5 years of his research on immigrants' rights in Los Angeles. So welcome, Sasha.
Great. Thanks, Samar. So I'm excited to be here, and you know, this is usually a much longer talk. I guess the format here is typically sort of 15 to 20 minutes, maybe stretching to 30, and then conversation. So I guess I'll try and just hit on some of the key points, and we can feel free to jump in if you want to at any time, and we'll do this a little bit more informally.
Unprecedented wave of protests, as many as 2 million people took to the streets on Monday in more than 100 cities and towns around the country to march for immigrants' rights.
If we can put that in a context of millions of dollars that we produce every single day, just think about it, the impact that we're going to cause on May 1st.
So I just wanted to give that quick clip as a context to the research that I've been doing with the immigrant rights movement in Los Angeles, starting in around 2006 up through the present day. And so this, of course, is all footage taken from short clips from all around the country from people who were involved in the mobilizations against the Sensenbrenner bill, which, if you recall, was the Republican legislation that would have criminalized the fact of being undocumented or providing any type of aid to anybody who was undocumented, including educators, health workers, et cetera. So this provoked the largest wave of street mobilizations that the United States has ever seen. And I had just moved to LA to do my doctoral work at the University of Southern California. And coming out of a background of both independent media production and also social movement scholarship, I immediately said, well, clearly this is the place that I need to focus. This is the nexus, the most interesting sort of and vibrant social movement that's happening, at least in Los Angeles at the time. And I then focused on that work for the next few years. The larger research question that I'm looking at and that all of my work looks at is this one, which is: under what conditions do social movements effectively use networked communication tech to strengthen movement identity, win political and economic victories, and transform consciousness? And the methods that I'm using are based on action research, building on communication for social change. Some of you might be familiar with Alfonso Gumucio Dagrón and the Rockefeller Foundation's multi-year initiative to kind of look at participatory development communication and build a stronger theoretical framework around that, and kind of sort of draw lessons from about 30 years of largely UNESCO-funded development communication projects, and really thinking about how do you design and develop communication tools, processes, and strategies that are actually owned by the communities that you're supposed to be working with. So this draws from popular education methodology and from a participatory design framework. And we can talk more about that later. So I'm gathering evidence basically in workshops, hands-on workshops that I'm doing with different community-based organizations around Los Angeles that work with low-wage immigrant workers. I'm building an archive of social movement media, so pulled from across the social web, of course, but in addition to that, newsletters, pamphlets, flyers, leaflets, recordings of radio shows. We'll come back to radio in a minute. But so basically archives of social movement media and interviews. So today I'm going to talk about interviews there's a larger set of people that I worked with, but today I'll focus more on about 25 movement organizers, media makers, folks working both in sort of the traditional labor unions as well as in worker centers, which are sort of more community-oriented spaces where people are organizing in Los Angeles and increasingly around the country, and also people who work for the mass media, both Anglo and Spanish language print and broadcast, and also folks from foundations, so funders. You know, limitations of the research, you know, my own sort of standpoint as a white, male, college-educated U.S. citizen who speaks only English and Spanish fluently. Los Angeles, of course, is a widely diverse place where there's immigrant rights organizing happening across a lot of different communities, and so those two languages sort of limit my ability to work with a number of the interesting organizations and movement formations there, but, you know, there's that. And the generalizability of the study, of course, I'm focused on L.A., and I'm focused on the immigrant rights movement between 2006 and 2009. So the next step of this research is actually to try and see if the transmedia mobilization framework that I'm developing, you know, does it work across other spaces, across other times, and across other movements. Los Angeles. I won't talk too much about, you know, LA. We could spend all day, other than to kind of highlight that, you know, LA is a key site for migrant labor. It has a rich and diverse social movement history, and it's an interesting space where new organizing models have developed and then spread across the country. So, well, we don't look at blurry graphics, but basically, you know, this is a low-wage workforce in Los Angeles from 2008. Looking at nativity, foreign-born status, the different sectors that people work in. Basically, we've got about, you know, somewhere around half of the population of Los Angeles working in the low-wage workforce, and of those, the large majority being undocumented, large majority of them being Latino, about 75%. And then we've got a lot of folks, a quarter of that workforce, working in garment manufacturing, domestic service, restaurants and hotels, and construction and day labor. And, you know, we could come back to this if people are more interested, but basically you have a massive low-wage undocumented workforce of largely Latino from Mexico and Central America working in domestic work, garment work, light manufacturing, hotels, and you have a lot of interesting new organizing models that have come out of LA and then spread across the country. So LA is one of the sites where you know, the national labor organizations, especially SEIU and then the Change to Win Coalition, basically decided instead of the sort of failing strategy of trying to exclude recent immigrants from unionization efforts that they'd sort of pursued over the 40 years from the 1950s up into the 80s, starting around in the 1990s, really started saying, well, these are the folks who are actually doing the low-wage work and we need to figure out how to organize them. So you have a complete shift. The rise of the Justice for Janitors campaign, which then went national. You know, a lot of that comes out of work that happened in Los Angeles. You have interesting sort of worker center models like the Garment Worker Center and the Koreatown Immigrant Workers Alliance. So these are models where instead of just organizing in a particular workplace or by sector, you're organizing, well, Garment Worker Center is by sector. They're organizing garment workers. HIWA, the Koreatown Immigrant Workers Alliance, is organizing geographically. So they're trying to organize a community union in Koreatown to have impacts both on sort of working conditions, but also in terms of urban design. They just recently won a victory where they've got the first sort of large green space in Koreatown through a community organizing campaign where they won a multi-million dollar you know, green space in K-Town. They've won $7 million of back wages for restaurant workers and for supermarket workers. So very successful, interesting models of organizing across race and ethnic lines. So organizing Latino kitchen staff together with Korean serving staff in the restaurant industry in K-Town. So a lot of interesting stuff going on there. In addition to sort of autonomous organizing, so East Los Angeles is one of the homes of La Otra Campaña del Otro Lado, or the other campaign of the other side, which is a sort of Zapatista-affiliated, indigenous-oriented, decentralized and power-sharing approach to movement organizing and strategy that sort of grew up out of East LA Chicano politics and has done a lot of sort of interesting organizing in that space over the last 10 years. That's a little bit about LA. And then the case, of course, I'm looking at the immigrant rights movement. I tried to not center particular organizations. I really think that it's interesting, in trying to understand social movements and think about how social movements are using media and media technologies across a range of platforms, it's important not to get caught up in particular individuals or organizations that try and position themselves as sort of the center of the movement. Because when we see a moment like 2006 or, you know, the current wave of revolutions that's sweeping, you know, North Africa and the Gulf states, it's basically, yes, there are long histories of organizing. Yes, there are powerful institutional actors. But at the moment of mass mobilization, you have what I like to call social movement formations, which is a wide range of actors, organizations, networks, and people who've never been affiliated with any of those things before getting involved in the movement moment. So that's why I'm centering a social movement formation as sort of the key unit of analysis when I'm trying to understand how it is that movements work with media. And of course, the context is massive and widespread and persistent digital inequality. And I don't need to spend much time on these slides. This is NTIA from last summer. You know, we know that basically working households, where if you're making minimum wage, you're in this bottom bracket here, which means that 30% have broadband at home, maybe, as opposed to households over 100,000, we're talking over 80% up into 90%. This is 2010. Same thing. If you look at broadband at home by race, we've got persistent digital inequality. Again, this is the NTIA study. I don't think I need to spend much time on this here, right? So, broadband access at home and access to all types of communication technology continues to be deeply stratified, mostly by income, to some degree by race and country of origin, a little bit by gender and by geography. But really, income is the primary predictor. In California, the numbers sort of mirror the national numbers. So this is Pat Brown Public Policy Institute of California in 2009. We've got 40% broadband at home among Latinos. But then once you start to look at language proficiency and nativity, you really see that even that 40% is high. English speaking at home. U.S. citizen Latinos are pulling up the numbers, so that actually when you go and look at this low-wage immigrant working population that I'm studying and looking at that make up the bulk of the mobilizations in 2006, you're really talking about below 20%, probably even below 10% broadband in the home access. And even dial-up is probably only around 30% for that community. This is another way to look at similar data. This is Ali Modaris and Bill Pitkin from 2006. They've done a more recent version of this, which looks very similar. They developed a composite socioeconomic status index and a composite technology index, and basically just mapped the geographic distribution of digital access inequality in Los Angeles County. And what you find, surprise, surprise, is that, they map spatially onto each other, so that, where you have low socioeconomic status, this is central LA and south LA, maps directly onto the places where people have low levels of composite technology access, which is a combined measure of computer in the home, do they have broadband or dial-up, do they number of mobile phones in the home, et cetera. So massively unequal, and the population that mobilizes the largest street protests in US history is the same population that has the least access of any to new digital tools. So minus one for internet exceptionalism, maybe. Some people say, well, wait, but what about the youth? Wasn't it the Latino youth must have all been online, and so really, they actually were using these tools? And the answer is, well, yeah, yes and no. We know from Pew that we continue to have basically a class-based stratification of uptake and use of digital tools. So who are the content creators? By and large, it's teens from wealthier households that have more steady access to the tools. Not exclusive, it's complicated. Yes, we have new findings on content creation on mobile devices, but still, I think that no one would really argue that the kids of these families that I'm looking at involved in this mobilization have less access to these tools than anyone else. So we'll come back to that in a minute. We'll come back to the digital access inequality in a minute. But so from looking at this series of workshops I've done, the interviews I've done, looking at the movement media archives, I've tried to sort of develop a theoretical framework that'll help us understand in a more complicated way how is it that social movements are interacting with the broader media space without separating out necessarily, you know, what does the internet do for social movements? I think it's, well, I don't want to say more interesting, but my particular approach is to start from the social movement formation and then try and understand better how are they using whatever tools may be available across the whole media space, you know, to organize and mobilize. And I'm calling this the media opportunity structure, which of course is, you know, drawn from the idea of the political opportunity structure from sociology-based social movement theory, McCarthy, Zald, Calhoun, et cetera. It's an idea that has been developed a little bit in the past. Gamson talks a little bit about the media opportunity structure. But the way that it's been used before is primarily as something that's sort of static. It's like the media opportunity structure is this sort of fixed, it really just means the media system. And I think that the idea of media opportunity structure really opens up the field for us as scholars to try and understand how is this changing over time? And so how do the new tools and the new spaces of social media, but not just social media, also the rise of Spanish language broadcast media, including Spanish language commercial radio and also television. How do those new spaces really open up opportunities for social movements to become visible, to organize, to mobilize resources? And so in the context of Los Angeles in 2006, the first thing that you notice is how important radio continues to be. The reason why millions of people turned out in the streets of Los Angeles repeatedly all throughout the spring of 2006 is primarily because the Spanish language radio locutores, or the talk show hosts on sort of these raunchy morning Spanish language shows that everyone listens to on their way to work and when they get to work and when they're cleaning the kitchens in the morning and when they're working in the garment shops, all of the six most popular Spanish language locutores decided, instead of just sort of competing for ratings with each other as they normally do, they were going to join forces and to defeat Sensenbrenner. And what they did is they started setting up conference calls. And so every day for a month leading up to these mobilizations, they would have these conference calls where every single station that they were on was just constantly broadcasting conversations about Sensenbrenner Bill, about the impacts it was going to have, and calling on people to come out to the street and mobilize to defeat this bill. And that was really the thing that mobilized people. At the same time, of course, the growth of social media and access to mobile phones is still an important factor. More than anything else, among teenagers and high school and to some degree middle school students in Los Angeles. So Los Angeles Unified School District during the spring of 2006 saw high school walkouts of over 20,000 students over a period of several weeks who literally shut down downtown Los Angeles, shut down the highways in LA, and generally participated fully in the larger mobilization context to block Sensenbrenner. And of course, they used, at the time, MySpace primarily to sort of circulate, flyers. They changed their profile pictures to images of the mobilizations and their names to For a Reason. This is a reference to Walk Out For a Reason. They created groups like, Fuck the HR 4437 and No on HR 4437 and Viva Aztlan and a whole sort of wide range of groups like that, which immediately gained thousands of members and became a venue for circulating information, calls to action, and updates as to what had happened in the streets. And so, to cut that piece short, since we don't have that much time today, I think it's useful for us, as scholars of media and movements, to think about what is the composition of the media opportunity structure and how is that changing over time, and how might that have impacts on social movements in their attempts to sort of organize. So again, in the context of the LA immigrant rights movement, the media opportunity structure is characterized by lack of access to English language print and broadcast media. Organizers constantly told me that, there was nothing they could do prior to this particular wave of massive mobilizations to get, press. Occasionally they could get, page, 10 in the LA Times, whatever. Increasing access to ethnic media, which means Spanish language commercial media, both print, La Opinión, and also the commercial radio broadcast system, and then the growth of social media and mobile media. And so, I would argue that if we find ways to operationalize the composition of the media opportunity structure, I think that we'll be able to then show sort of interesting impacts on social movement outcomes, however we want to measure them, whether we're going to use measures, cultural, political, economic, mobilization outcomes. There's a whole literature in social movement scholarship sort of breaking down different ways to measure social movement outcomes, and I think that we would probably find some impacts in terms of the media opportunity structure. The next sort of key concept that I synthesized from all this work is transmedia mobilization. I won't read this to you. You can probably read it even from the back of the room. This, of course, is drawing from initially Marcia Kinder's work on sort of the flow of branded commodities across different media platforms. But then more recently, Henry Jenkins has taken up this term and really argued that in a converged media space, what major cultural producers do, if they really want to figure out how to maximize the impact of a narrative, is they figure out how to spread that narrative across different platforms and provide different entry points to people who might be fans in different media to sort of get engaged and then go deeper in the story. And you can only learn more about the story if you work across different spaces. So, you might initially launch something as a game. At the same time, you've got an online space dedicated to it. You're seeding forums. Meanwhile, you're producing a major motion picture, which is going to continue the narrative developed in the game, and so on. So you're building worlds. You're working across media. It's not just taking a particular sort of, branded cultural commodity and then spreading it out. It's actually making the narrative flow across these different spaces. And so one of the things that I'm interested in is this question is this something that's happening within social movement spaces as well, or is it only something that's, being done by the major cultural industries? And, you can probably guess my answer is I think that it is happening in social movement spaces as well. Another interesting thing that came out of the conversations that I had with people is this idea that I think social movement scholars have neglected, which is the impact on movement identity production that making media actually has. So there's a little bit of scholarship on this, but not too much. This is really, it's a pretty simple idea, right? It's just that in the process of actually producing media related to a particular movement's goals and narrative, people come to identify more with that movement, get more and more deeply involved, and then are thus more likely to go on and participate in sort of movement activity more broadly. And I have a lot of people who I talked to who said things that make me think, that there's something here. So this was one organizer that I talked to who said that, she wasn't politicized at all until she got involved in translating transcripts for this documentary called Made in LA, which was actually sort of, broadcast on PBS. It was a major documentary. So she got involved in the production process of this film, translating some of these transcripts from Spanish into English, and through that she became more and more politicized as she was reading the text of these different interviews and getting involved in this media production process. So I don't think that it's something that's exclusive to social media. I think that it's something that that happens across different types of media spaces, and that basically working on media and making media makes people sort of identify more strongly with social movements, and make media make trouble is the idea. And that would probably be -2 for internet exceptionalism or something. Although maybe not, because of course it's easier to make media once the tools and skills of digital literacy have become much more widespread. So yes, it makes it easier, although it's not something that I think only happens in making digital media or in the online space. I don't really have time to show this, which is too bad, but we can talk about it maybe later. This is an example. Are you familiar with the Basta Dobbs campaign? Anyone sort of see this? Oh man. Okay. So this was a campaign organized by Presente.org, which is basically was launched 3 years back as an attempt to sort of develop a Latino Move On. So this was the idea: is how do we develop a mass mailing list to advocate, for Latino communities in the United States? And the model was, Move On's, email action alert system, except that since the community that they're trying to work with has such low levels of access, to broadband in the home and so on, that mobile phones become central. So it's basically massive text messaging action alert system built on the MoveOn model. But what's really interesting about presented.org, so one, the Bassa Dobbs campaign was a nationwide campaign to remove Lou Dobbs from CNN, which was ultimately successful. This had been tried a number of times by different organizers, and never with any success. And I'll show a short clip from the Lou Dobbs, from the Bassa Dobbs campaign's video, and then I'll explain a little bit more about how they actually did this organizing.
This October, CNN will take an unprecedented look at the story of Latinos in America. We have so many stories to tell.
We're a rich culture. We've got a lot to offer to this country.
Criminal illegal aliens.
Overwhelmed by criminal illegal aliens, the illegal aliens are in the country, including many murderers and rapists.
Lou Dobbs has done more to slander Latin people in this country than any other single human being.
Mr. Dobbs represents an ongoing threat to CNN's credibility as a serious news organization.
Dobbs is the most guilty of the reckless, irresponsible journalism.
9-year-old Brisenia Flores shot and killed. One of the suspects is the national head of the Minuteman American Defense.
I support the Minuteman Project and the fine Americans who make it up in all they've accomplished fully, relentlessly, and proudly. The invasion of illegal aliens is threatening the health of many Americans. Tuberculosis, leprosy, malaria.
Now, we went to try and check that. We can't, just
but
so
I can
you know.
Tell you this. If we reported it, it's a fact.
You can't tell me that. You did.
Well, no, I just
it.
Did.
You distort the figures. You exaggerate.
A third of the prison population in this country is estimated to be illegal alien. About a third of our prison population who are illegal alien.
6% of prisoners in this country are non-citizens, not even illegal.
Yes, but I misspoke. If we reported it, it's a fact.
Mexico has become our enemy.
Fuck Mexico!
If you come here to mooch off of this country, why don't you go fix your own country? You
he's
fucking
the coward. He's the group.
I'm the coward.
You're
the fucking coward.
How am I a coward? I'm here by myself. I'm
coward.
Surrounded by Minutemen and I'm the coward?
Latinos are the chief victims of ethnically motivated hate crimes.
They told us that the whole property was surrounded with border patrol, and so they just shot my husband, and they shot my daughter, and they shot me.
The worst thing you can do is do nothing and say nothing and not act when your voice is needed. People want change. The time is now.
So a very effective video. And so this was sort of one of the centerpieces of the Bassa Dobbs campaign. The way that they I saw a wonderful presentation by the organizer of this at Netroots Nation last summer. They had a three-tiered timeline of their campaign with their social media strategy, their broadcast media strategy, and their street mobilization strategy, and how each one sort of drove the other. So they began by actually buying a unlimited flight ticket on JetBlue Airlines, traveled around the country, and went to every Spanish-language radio stations in every major market. Went on the air, played clips of Lou Dobbs, and at the end gave people this text campaign information if they wanted to sort of, you know, if you want to do something about this text in. And very quickly, in a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, managed to build up an initial list of about 30,000 or 40,000, mobile phone numbers. So that was sort of stage one, was using Spanish language radio, where the base that they wanted to organize was. Step two was they then texted out to all of those people, this weekend, go to your local CNN office and, you know, bring signs, you know, related to the campaign. And then they, of course, used their existing press contacts you know, some of the organizers of this were actually quite involved with New America Media for the last, 10 years. So they had very extensive sort of, press contacts within, traditional, print and broadcast media. So they basically earned, coverage by doing these street mobilizations. That got them in both English and Spanish language print press, which then, of course, drives broadcast coverage. So then, the print stories then got them, TV coverage and also radio coverage on English language radio. And of course, they made sure to always insert in all the coverage they got this, text BASTA to 30644, so that every time that they got a hit, they were then actually growing their text message list. So then the next step from there was to sort of move into the online space. So once they had then sort of crossed over from the initial folks they were mobilizing who had the mobile phones over and started getting more English language coverage, they started driving more people to their website to watch this video. So then they started getting more sort of solidarity supporters. So folks who weren't necessarily directly affected or aren't Latino, but, progressive non-Latino folks, or folks who are Latino but are citizens who then wanted to sort of support this campaign via the online space. So again, basically, it's just a very conscious and strategic decision to figure out how do you move back and forth between these different media spaces. It's not just about doing a really good online campaign. It's not just about getting good coverage on Spanish language radio. It's about how do you move between the mobile space, Spanish language radio, Anglo print and broadcast, and the online space. And so I think this is a really good example of what I'm talking about when I talk about moving a narrative across and between spaces. And of course, the street mobilizations, which are what, also earn them additional coverage. Another thing that I found is that people are moving from, social movement communicators are increasingly moving from just sort of being content creators to being curators and circulators. So people who in the past might have been, say, a communications staff at a small nonprofit, rather than spending all their time just making media, creating the message for the movement, instead they're increasingly spending time looking at media that their base is producing and then pulling it in, finding sort of the best stuff, maybe remixing it, and then pushing it back out through the context they have, including into print and broadcast media. So this is really a kind of shift in the strategies that people are using to try and build participation in social movements. I'll skip this example because we don't have time. Maybe this is the last example that I'll give, and then probably we should talk. So I mentioned the walkouts before, and what I wanted to talk about was how the English language press sort of noticed these walkouts and did a whole bunch of stories about how, these high school students are amazing. They organized these walkouts completely on MySpace. Nobody saw it coming. It was in these social networking spaces. And I'm not going to argue against that. MySpace, was important, and social networking sites were an important place for them to organize and mobilize. At the same time, I just feel like we're missing most of the story if we just focused on what happened, on MySpace when we look at the high school walkouts in LA in 2006. So just a few other pieces of the story. So one would be that in 2004 and 2005, Edward James Olmos finished shooting this made-for-TV film called Walkout, which is sort of a historical fiction about the Chicano blowouts in East Los Angeles in the late 1960s, when high school students in Los Angeles Unified School District organized weeks of walkouts of the high schools to protest the unequal distribution of resources throughout the school system, what they saw as racism inside the school system, and the lack of culturally relevant literature, history, art, and other texts in their classrooms. So he had been producing this film, and in fact had gone to many of the schools in East LA to find students to participate in the production of this film. And this had happened just the year before. This is in 2005. I'll show you this is a quick clip from the film as it aired. For some reason, the audio is really low. This is dramatization of students in 1968 discussing and debating, what tactics they should use to try and, win more resources for schools in East LA. And there's this moment where they all kind of say, You know, well, how what does it mean to walk out? That doesn't make any sense. You know, then we're just not getting an education at all. And then this this organizer says, well, no, it's like the South. The, you know, our schools are the buses of the South. And so we have to boycott the school system in order to, you know, make the power structure listen. And everybody goes, yeah, let's walk out. And so it's very, you know, it's cheesy. You know, the script is kind of, you know, cornily written, but it's, a, you know, it's a historical dramatization aired on HBO. But in the process of creating that, you know, they went around and they found all these students who then documented their participation in the filming of Walkout. And so here they are posting to YouTube, you know, here's the scene in Walkout that I'm in. So this is a, you know, this is a student basically, I think, filming with their cell phone camera. Once Walkout airs on TV, they're filming it from their TV, capturing it, and then reposting it onto YouTube, and then sending links to the YouTube video around to all their friends on MySpace. And again, this is all happening immediately before the walkouts actually take place. Here we have an AIM discussion that somebody copied from their participation in the walkout. This is later, this is in 2007. But basically, they have a chat with their friend about how awesome the walkout was. You know, it was so much fun. 500 students left the school. I was laughing my ass off. It was crazy. You know, I can't wait till next year's walkout. That, this kind of stuff. So discussing what had actually happened and then reposting that. So this is a screen grab of an AIM chat, which they then posted on their MySpace wall and sent around to all their friends. It's sort of just the public conversation about what it means to participate in a mobilization in the context of the high school walkouts. So I think what we're seeing here is something that's a lot more complicated than sort of just my students organize the walkouts on MySpace. Students are drawing on the repertoire of contention that their parents participated in the 1968 and 1969 Chicano blowouts. They're referencing them. Their experience of it is mediated both through their family histories, but also through participating in the production of this HBO special, which airs. It actually, not only does it air, but Edward James almost did pre-release screenings in six high schools all around LA in December. In January of 2006, and then the walkouts happened in March. So literally, this social movement tactic as a sort of relevant historical and present-day strategy to support the mobilizations against Sensenbrenner is sort of richly mediated across all of these different spaces. And so that's, again, what I'm sort of talking about when I encourage us to think about what transmedia mobilization might mean, as opposed to just sort of looking at what's happening in the social media spaces. And this is just another sort of quick example. This is, you know, A Day Without a Mexican, and here's another MySpace post. If HR 4437 is passed, no work, no school, May 1st will be the day without Latinos. The movie A Day Without a Mexican will become real. So, you know, people are referencing these broader, you know, pop cultural texts across a range of different spaces, remediating them and recirculating them in the process of generating narratives about what it means to participate in a social movement. And this is just another quote from an organizer, which is sort of similar to what I said before. So rather than just producing all the media themselves, organizers within the context of this particular movement space are starting to say, well, everybody in the movement base is producing media. We need to switch to figuring out how do we pull them in and find the really good stuff and then recirculate it. And so in this case, the strategy was to print out flyers and ask people who had video cameras documenting the protests to wherever they were going to upload them, if they could just tag them with a particular shared tag, that would then make the organizer's job easier. You know, later when they go looking for media that's been produced by movement actors, they can find that stuff and they can aggregate it and then they can sort of recirculate it across social media spaces. So basically, some of the transmedia mobilization practices that I identified are the way that participating in media production helps people identify with movements. Media production happens across all kinds of media platforms. There's media bridging work that's done where people sort of grab examples of media from different spaces, package it together, and then spread it out, especially via social media. And there's a shift from content production to content aggregation, curation, remix, and recirculation. How much more time do I have here? It's 1:12 and we're supposed to be done at 1:30. Is that right? 1:45. Okay, I'll skip this piece. This is a whole section about how in the context of massive digital inequality, but the growth of these new practices of transmedia mobilization, I'm arguing that social movement organizers really need to, especially if they're working with a base that doesn't have high levels of digital access, really need to make fairly central digital media literacy trainings, and that means read-write digital media literacy. And if that's not part of your movement-building strategy, if you're trying to work with low-income communities, then you know, then you're really missing out on one of the most important functions of social movement organizing now. And I think that movements that, do that and know that will be much more successful than movements that ignore that space. That would be a plus one for internet exceptionalism, maybe. If you don't get involved in helping your base learn how to use these new tools, then you know your movement is toast. And then the last piece that I won't go into detail, but you know, was the ways that social movement structure has big impacts on whether people are able to effectively participate in transmedia mobilization practices and leverage the changed media opportunity structure to build their movements and circulate their narratives. And in a nutshell, what this means is that top-down movement structures are really bad at doing transmedia mobilization, and social movement structures and organizers that are interested in more horizontal and participatory styles of organizing are much better positioned to actually take advantage of these new tools and skills and strategies of organizing. And I have a number of examples that I talk about the attempt of some professionalized nonprofits in LA to distance themselves from organizers who were brutally attacked by LAPD in MacArthur Park in 2007 on May Day. I don't have enough time to do this one, so you can ask me about it later. And I have another example, which is the Fast for Our Future, which was in the lead up to the election, a sort of interesting 21-day fast for immigrant rights that happened in La Placita Olvera, which is the historic heart of downtown LA. And I look at sort of all the different media tools that were used by organizers there and sort of the clashes between especially some of the folks from organized labor who participated there, from SEIU especially, who had a more sort of top-down idea about what the media strategy should look like, and some of the more horizontalist organizers who built a whole sort of social media strategy, and then some of the conflicts and tensions that happened there. You know, a lot of people said things like this, you know, I'm constantly frustrated by trying to, you know, I get contracted to work with these big, you know, national nonprofit organizations, and they want me to do social media strategy, but then they just, they want to use, you know, Twitter as a broadcast mechanism, and they just, you know, they just don't get it. And so nobody follows them because who wants to, you know, use Twitter as just a broadcast mechanism? I talk about the challenges of getting credit and funding. So in the context of a social movement space that has been largely professionalized over the last, especially, say, 30 years since the civil rights movement, 30, 40 years, one of the things that happens is that you know, formally incorporated nonprofit organizations are all competing for actually relatively small pools of funding to do the same or very similar work. So part of that means being able to go to funders and take credit for particular movement successes and victories. And so that is in conflict with the transmedia mobilization strategy, where instead of being the sole voice and the content creator and the one taking all the credit, you know, you would be inviting a wide range of actors across an entire network to all participate in a particular media strategy. But then what do? You go to the funder and say, well, yeah, we participated as one among 100,000 people who all documented this mobilization. And they say, okay, but what did you do? And you say, well, I don't know, we were one of 10,000 people. And they say, well, why should I give you the money? And so instead, your tendency is to say, you know, we did X, we did Y. You want to take sort of credit for social movement successes and victories, which potentially actually runs very sort of contra to what I'm looking at in terms of the broader way that social movement formations that extend beyond particular individual organizations or networks are actually the place where real pressure is generated to transform policies and win significant movement victories. So that's a problem. So I talk about the competing horizontal logics and vertical logics and some of the different sort of actors involved in these different spaces. Just one last one that I thought was kind of interesting is the fear of haters. You know, constantly people that I talked to from professionalized groups, they were just so terrified that if they opened up any of their online spaces or their media strategy to participation by the movement base, that they would just be, you know, inundated by trolls who would just destroy their campaign. And with, you know, with some, you know, obviously there are good reasons to worry about that kind of thing. But when I asked them whether this had ever happened, I didn't find one organizer who was ever able to tell me, yes, we opened up, we did an open transmedia, you know, strategy. And I don't care if they use the term transmedia. I couldn't find anyone who said we did an open space and we tried to invite people across the movement formation to participate, but we had to close it down and shut it down because it was inundated by trolls. Instead, they all just assumed that that was something that was going to happen, so they never created an open space. So they completely failed to take advantage of these new tools. So as opposed to sort of, you know, the ethos of the free software movement and free culture movement, which would be, you know, well, let's keep things as open as possible as long as we can. And if we're hit by trolls, then we'll find strategies to try and shut them down and deal with it. Instead, professionalized nonprofits, at least in the immigrant rights movement in LA, and I think more broadly than that, tend to assume, well, let's keep it closed and maybe we'll occasionally experiment with opening things up a little bit, which is not a good way to operate, I think, or I would argue. So I guess I'll just stop there. You know, these were my main arguments for my research findings. Movements should take advantage of the changed media opportunity structure, engage in transmedia mobilization, teach their base digital literacy skills if they want them to participate, and shift to a kind of curation and recirculation role rather than just a content ownership and creation role. Lots of questions. I need to sort of see, does this framework work across different movements, across different spaces? And then I have a more formal model, which is sort of basically a, you know, social movement theory, you know, classic model of where the media is, and then the new model that I argue for in terms of how the media opportunity structure and transmedia mobilization sort of interface with each other. But, you know, formal blurry models, you know, whatever, we can look at those another time. So that's pretty much it, and let's talk about it. Okay, the first hand was back here.
Nolan Bowie. Do you know of any organized efforts by advocacy groups and social movement groups to lobby school boards to include media literacy that would be inclusive of not only teaching students how to deconstruct messages, but to create their own and to produce and distribute them using new media?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this has been a big battle. There's a lot of educators who are trying to figure out how to bring, you know, critical media literacy, you know, into schools. New Mexico Media Literacy Project is actually one of the groups that I interviewed some of their organizers in talking about this. Even though they're outside of Los Angeles, they've produced a whole bunch of sort of curricular materials that are being used by groups in LA. IDEPSCO, which is the Institute of Popular Education of Southern California, actually has created a digital media curriculum called Aprendamos, We Learn, and they're bringing that into grade schools, actually, doing sort of trainings in digital media tools, you know, with grade school and middle school students. I think it's always, there's a lot of tensions there because, you know, this is the communists sneaking their agenda into and poisoning our children's minds, right, with, you know, critical media literacy, breaking down mass media messages. You know, I have yet to see, okay, well, I could temper that. I was going to say I have yet to see an effective right-wing critical media literacy curriculum, but in fact, to some degree, that's what Glenn Beck does with his chalkboard, right? I mean, so this is, you know, you could say this is a, you know, media literacy from the right. He's trying to break down the connections, and I mean, I don't know. But in terms of actually bringing it into the schools, yes, there's a long history of people trying to do that, but it's a very difficult thing to do. There's a lot of political resistance to doing that kind of work. Jeff?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Sasha. That was fantastic. I have a question. Transmedia mobilization, sort of, you're talking about within particular movement formations. Have you looked at it across different movement formations, so particularly across the right-left divide? You know, in particular, I was living in Arizona at the time of a lot of this stuff, doing some organizing and research. And one of the things, you might remember the No Borders camp that we organized. One of the things we did, it's interesting, we had this sort of direct action. It was a cross-border kissing booth. I don't know if you remember this, but the Border Patrol broke us up violently, and we had this all caught on YouTube. and we put the YouTube video on the web, and it was really interesting to see Minutemen folks sort of engaging in debate over the meaning of this video and drawing completely different lessons. And one of the things we saw, I think, were images from the right circulating among, you know, sort of groups on the left and vice versa. And I'm wondering if you saw any of that or if that would be interesting in terms of your model. In particular, many people argue that sort of the overall impact of all this was kind of a right-wing reaction, people like Leo Chavez and others. So I'm wondering what sort of what that does for this kind of model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, so the primary impact of the 2006 mobilizations was to defeat the Sensenbrenner bill. So that's certainly a social movement victory. Of course, now we have the backlash and we have SB 1070, and that's sort of spreading across, you know, state by state. But it's a great question. I think that it certainly, I don't know if I would call it transmedia mobilization in the way that I'm framing that, but certainly people are looking at text produced by the other side. I mean, that's the Bassa Dobbs, you know, campaign video is primarily composed of, you know, basically cutting up and remixing, you know, Lou Dobbs' own sort of words against him. So I certainly think that there's sort of a tradition of definitely satire and critical remix of text by the opposition, and I think that does happen on both sides. In terms of creating a narrative across both, I think they're different, they're competing narratives, so it wouldn't necessarily fit into the framework the way that I'm defining it. But it would be interesting to also look at, transmedia mobilization across movement formations, which certainly I think happens. So, you know, between, you know, what would be considered issue-based, you know, organizing, actually sharing and trying to figure out how to generate master narratives. So between, you know, eco-justice and media justice and immigrant rights and sort of groups trying to figure out in what ways can they generate narratives that will bring in other movement networks to kind of support them, or, you know, ordering pizza from Cairo for folks in Wisconsin, or, you know, the kind of stuff that we're seeing now. Go ahead.
Thanks. This is Ian Condrey, and it's very interesting. A couple of things you were saying made me think about this relationship between transmedia and mobilization. And, you know, it seems to me that one of the interesting things is that we still talk about media as a kind of message, right? Content, how does this narrative and world move across media? And that once we have a kind of story, that has a power to mobilize. But as you were talking, I was thinking maybe it's the other way around, right? That this some of our confusion about transmedia and how do we study media when it's all these different affordances and technologies becomes quite simple if you say, well, no, it's the people, right? It gets back to this question, too, about how the same message, the same image, the same content can be read very differently. And that difference, then, is not about the content or even the narrative so much as it is the groups who care about it and the way the media connects them. And it especially struck me when you were saying that, you know, it wasn't necessary to get mainstream media access so much as ethnic media access, right? So that it's not so much the message to everybody, it's a message to a particular group that matters. And this idea that media making is in fact maybe more important than whatever message gets out because of it, which again, then it's not really about the narrative, it's about the mobilization. And so that's where I was thinking that, so the interesting thing about your examples here is not so much the narrative moving across media as it is the mobilization that finds its way through a variety of media, and the narrative probably actually means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And so I guess that's what I was curious whether that makes sense, or if so, does that mean we need to rethink what is this transmedia connection?
Well, I would certainly agree that I think that we've understudied and under-theorized the role of media production in social movement identity formation. And, you know, I think that it's really key. And I think that it's something that, you know, may have always been the case, but historically less people were able to participate in producing the media for the movement and producing the movement narratives. Now many more people are able to participate, and I think that's a really important and crucial change. I think that you're right that I would stop at saying that that's more important than the narrative that's produced, because I do think that by all of these people participating in producing the narrative or multiple narratives that then maybe cluster around master narratives, you know, that's also a change, and that's what traditional top-down movement organizations are so scared of. Right. Is losing control
stay
of that
message,
master message.
Right?
Stay on message, stay on message.
What are your talking points? Right?
Yeah, they've been working for, you know, they've been trained for at least, you know, 40 years. You know, funders are constantly holding workshops where they teach their grantees how to do media strategy. And the one thing they, you know, always tell them is, this is how you stay on message, you stay on message, you know, repeat the message. And I think that some of that has to change. And I think, actually, in 2011, it's just starting to change. Some of the funders are now have started to understand the social media space, and are, some of them are now starting to hire social media consultants to work with their grantees to teach them how the social media space maybe is different than the print and broadcast media space. I still don't think they really understand how it can really work most effectively together, how the stories that you tell can move across those spaces, as we saw in the Basta Dobbs campaign, and how that's the most interesting and explosive, you know, potential to engage more people. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered the question, but I think it's a great field for further research and for trying to understand better, you know, how it is that actually is operating on the ground. And I do think that there's a lot of people now who their primary, the first way that they become involved with social movement activity is through producing media in some context. They go to their friend invites them to a march, you know, they're not really that into it, but they like to shoot videos or, you know, whatever, or they just have their camera with them, they come to the march, it's compelling, there's interesting imagery, they start taking pictures, they start circulating it, you know, via social media spaces, and they're hooked. And then they've, you know, and then by circulating that media, you know, other people then are gonna sort of comment and send them links to clips they produce of the same action from a different perspective, and people then start, you know, sort of the media flows and sharing that content, which has been produced by participants, becomes a sort of an interesting activity that draws people further and further into movement mobilization. And I think it's an important shift. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll just say a couple of observations. I really like your observations, but I have a couple of negative observations that are unrelated superficially. And the first is that we hear a lot about sound bites in media and now 140-character tweets and everything very short. I noticed the Basta Dobbs film was very heavily edited and very emotional, which is fair. So, but the question comes down to, when are people actually studying the issues? And the second observation is that actually, even though those marches in 2006 were enormous, they didn't seem to lead to a sustained grassroots movement. We saw a lot less when the Arizona bill came out. I wonder if those two observations actually are related.
Well, I would disagree in terms of, did they lead to a sustained movement? I think that there's a very strong movement, especially around SB 1070 right now. Mm-hmm. The problem is that, that's a much longer conversation, like mm-hmm. analysis of what happened to the immigrant rights movement, you know, post 2006. You know, my analysis, and you know, coming from a lot of the folks that I interviewed, is that part of what happened is that the incoming Obama administration met with the D.C.-based, nationally funded immigrant rights organizations and said, "Okay, it's time to switch from protest mode to get out the vote." And some of the major funders said, "You know, we'll give you money to do that work now that we defeated H.R. 4437." And they bit it. You know, they took the bait, and so they demobilized their base and they got involved in the get out the vote efforts. And then, what did they get out of it? They got greater enforcement, increased deportations, enforcement-only policy, and not even a bone. They couldn't even get the DREAM Act through. I think that's a larger, you know, macro political, you know, and economic question around how that all played out. I don't think it's related to the media strategies that were used necessarily, but it's, yeah.
There's particularly the issues of the funders, and I was interested how you positioned them in a kind of in a learning space, and how they're kind of beginning to get this kind of new paradigm of kind of open and decentralized sort of sharing. It seems to me that the funders themselves are in a pressure environment where they themselves have to adhere to a proprietary branding exercise. You know, basically there's a humanitarian disaster. First thing that happens is that the different tents carry the different logos of the different funders.
Right.
So the funders themselves are, you know, are in a sense in the same, sort of stuck in the same logic. And I'm intrigued by, you know, if this is action research, then how can we think further about how can we make the open spaces and the proprietary spaces and their logics basically merge or communicate with each other. So this idea of brands flowing across open spaces, for example, might be a compromise solution, or what other strategies can you see to basically use the political economy as it is to still support movements like these?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And, you know, and funders, you know, aren't this, you know, monolith, right? Funders are program officers who have portfolios and are responsible within a certain amount of time for producing measurable, you know, victories and changes through the groups that they choose to fund. And I think, you know, one thing we could do is the Berkman Center should convene a bunch of high-level funders to do a workshop on transmedia strategy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, educating the funders is work, and it's organizing work, and it's something I think would be immensely valuable for us to do.
Media literacy for funders.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What is the new media opportunity structure look like, and how might this impact the way that you choose to fund and do your work, and the way that you evaluate success and impact? I mean, maybe what you should be shooting for is not for your grantee to be the one who carried the campaign, but for, you know, was your grantee successfully able to, you know, generate a meme or a frame or a process which then spread beyond that particular grantee and was able to draw in a larger social movement formation to actually, you know, achieve the victory. So I think that's a wonderful idea, and we should do something with that.
I think related to Dorothea's question in your response, if the horizontal and vertical logics that you were talking about that are really in some ways in tension and in maybe other ways directly competing, there are certainly individual actors who are not just representing those logics but trapped in those. So the consultant who's likely also a grassroots organizer who wants to see the folks who are working outside of the MPIC, outside of the non-profit industrial complex, as folks have called it, folks who genuinely are working in that horizontal frame but also employed by the vertical.
Right.
Did you see examples of what they were doing beyond saying to the funders you should think differently about this, what they might be doing that could help us shift attention to the horizontal logic?
Yeah, I mean, I think they tend to do kind of what you're describing or hinting at, which is they have a day job which is working for the NPIC, and then they have their side projects which are what they really are sort of more excited about, and they try and develop more horizontal, you know, media strategy and spaces. But it's difficult because then they're, you know, they're working however many, you know, hours a week already. It's not particularly lucrative necessarily to do that kind of, you know, social media consulting anyway, unless you're one of a very, you know, the top of the pyramid of social media consultants, you know, get paid well to work with the largest nonprofits. But most of them working for these smaller, you know, community-based and mid-sized organizations, you know, are kind of, you know, struggling. So that definitely happens, and I think there's a lot to learn from people who are in that position. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we can invite them to our meeting with the funders, mm-hmm. Where they could finally tell the funders what they, you know, if they really could implement a transmedia strategy the way they've always wanted to, you know, what would it look like? Absolutely.
You talked about comparative analyses, so where would you begin with that, and do you see any difficulties in doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I would love to do would be to look at the immigrant rights movement in another city, even in another country. So this is a dynamic that's, you know, that's transnational now. And so looking at how, you know, what is immigrant rights, you know, mobilizations in Sao Paulo look like compared to what they look like in Los Angeles, and what is the media space, what affordances are there, and how is that the same or different? And then, you know, across movements as well. You know, a lot of people have suggested that I look next at a right-wing movement, you know, look at transmedia mobilization in the Tea Party, and sort of, you know, compare that to what's happened in the immigrant rights movement. That would be interesting. I mean, I guess what I'm wondering, and also maybe encouraging other people to do, is, you know, do we think this is a useful framework that I'm trying to develop and lay out here? And is it a way to do, you know, productive research? Because it's not like, you know, I'm going to be able to produce, you know, transmedia mobilization cases about all the social movements in the world, but I'd like to think that it might be a productive, you know, research strategy. So I'm hoping that other people will sort of, you know, take this up and help develop it further.
And your notion about looking around the world actually leads me back to your point, your critiques of new media exceptionalism, which is that in the U.S., I think you make a very persuasive point that transmedia strategies can be very effective, and that they're available. But they're available. I mean, one of the things about the new media is that there are lots of parts of the world where the old media is not available to folks trying to challenge the status quo. And so at least one piece of exceptionalism is just the availability of it. If it's available at all, individuals can use it to mobilize. And when the other media are simply unavailable, never will be available, there we are.
Well, what I'd like people to do is actually, when they're researching social movement media use, I'd like them to start with an analysis of the composition of the media opportunity structure. So, you know, you would say, these are the different channels that exist. This is the levels of access that different actors in the social movement formation have or don't have. And these are the spaces that there's potential for. And then you would say, well, are they actually leveraging the potential opportunities that exist or not? So I could imagine, doing this for, Tunisia and Egypt right now would be really, kind of fascinating to see what would come out of a transmedia mobilization analysis of what's happened there. I mean, I think, basically what we'd say is, well, there's two main factors. One is the social media space and the other is Al Jazeera. And that one of the main things that's happened is that Al Jazeera has been incredibly effective at doing what I'm describing here, which is aggregating and recirculating and amplifying voices from the social media space. So they literally have people looking what is being posted on Facebook, what is being posted on Twitter, in addition to having live reporters in real time. And then when they find interesting content that's been produced and circulated in social media spaces, grab it and then broadcast it via satellite TV across the region, which then in Tunisia, over 50% of the households in Tunisia have had illegal, access to Jazeera, and that's certainly the way that it was spread. The uprising was spread throughout many of the smaller cities, not through social media. Yeah, absolutely.
Great stuff, Sasha. Thanks. I wanted to ask. So, the stories that you tell seem to be largely kind of rallying the troops through effective transmedia or organizing. There's no Habermas in there. There's no militia sitting down in Starbucks with the Latinos trying to debate the issues here. Did you find evidence of that sneaking in there in places? So that's first question. The second question is, you talked about staying on message or not, and kind of implicitly making the distinction between bottom up and top down. It sounded like many of these had a very clear message. Where did the message come from, and how much of that can you track the mean through the organizations?
Well, I think this is where I think there's a lot of room to extend and develop this framework. I mean, I can certainly imagine even trying to quantitative measures of meme production and circulation across these different spaces would be really fascinating. Where did some of the primary messages and rallying cries, where were they produced and where did they come from? I think that probably we'd find combination of some of them produced by professional movement communicators who circulate them really broadly, and some of them produced through in a bottom-up process, which then sometimes then gets taken up by the more savvy professional communicators and recirculating. Look at Yes We Can, right? Yes We Can is the English translation of Si Se Puede, which is the rallying cry of the 2006 mobilizations, which of course comes from the history of UFW, Cesar Chavez, and all that mobilization. I mean, so the Democratic Party leadership made a very smart and effective decision to take a bottom-up, generated movement framing, which has a long history and then a very recent resonance in the 2006 mobilizations, and kind of appropriated in the messaging process. So certainly, I think things flow in both directions. In terms of the I don't know if I would agree that there's no public sphere here. I mean, I think this...
I don't know. I was asking a question. I think
this is the public sphere. I think this is what I'm describing. The media opportunity structure is, we could just call it the public sphere. And we could say, I think we need to analyze the composition of the public sphere. And the composition of the public sphere includes all, this variety of spaces. Media opportunity structure would just be, directly drawing from a particular group of social movement scholars and the way that they've framed political opportunity structures. But, maybe it's better to just call it the composition of the public sphere, which would include then, what I like about that is then that implicitly includes the face-to-face stuff as well. Whereas if you're just talking about the media opportunity structure, the face-to-face gets lost. Because of course the majority of the conversations that are happening about what are we going to write on our sign tomorrow when we go out to rally, that happens face-to-face in cafes and schoolhouses and community organizations, all throughout Los Angeles, where people are sitting around organizing this stuff and painting their signs and writing their blogs together and circulating the stuff on MySpace, and it is so I like that. Maybe we can do that instead.
Some of the strategies you described seem reminiscent of strategies that marketers are using increasingly, again, across media. So I guess I'm wondering about the interplay between the two, and if you see a convergence between social movement activism and brand marketing, product placement.
Convergence. Certainly, there's a number of people who are sort of think of themselves as movement communicators who come out of the branding and marketing world and then have tried to sort of apply those skills to social movement activity. At the same time, we have the corporate social responsibility crowd, which I wouldn't say they're necessarily aligning themselves with social movements, although some of the ideas and master narratives that they're trying to tap into certainly are ones that were generated by movements, especially in terms of in the space of the environmental movement, where language and concepts and frames developed by the environmental justice movement by the environmental movement and less so the environmental justice movement over the last 50 years have made their way, you know, I guess you could say finally up into corporate boardrooms, and to some degree are now that those narratives are then, you know, reproduced in some of the green branding campaigns. You know, to what degree it's greenwashing versus actual participation in extending a movement narrative, that's always debatable. I think there's certainly a lot of sort of cross-circulation back and forth. I also think that marketers have always looked to edge spaces, artists, social movement actors, people who were doing political remix especially for technical innovations,
yeah,
to then say, oh, well, here's an interesting, you know, here's an interesting thing that some, you know, some hacker built a video processing, you know, unit and then is using that to, you know, remix mass media content, and oh, wouldn't that be great to use in our next music video? I mean, I think that those things certainly happen. Technical innovation circulates across all different types of spaces of media producers, be they independent and grassroots and hackers, or be they, you know, very expensive professionals in Hollywood. I think there's circulation.
So, piggybacking a little bit on one of Rob's questions, the messages, the movements you describe, the movement that you describe, the movements I'm thinking of in the Middle East, there was a clear message, and one that could be significantly disputed. We've got a bill that we need to vote down. We want to see voted down. We've got a dictator we want to get rid of. And so it's hard to see, it's easy to see how sort of horizontality is not going to pose any problems and any great competing messages that are drowning one another out. How does the horizontality work when there isn't that galvanizing issue? And that is, if you're an established nonprofit, you're going to say, well, this is where we add the value, is that we can figure out where to go from here, and we can you know, make all the decisions and do all the studies and decide what is an appropriate position to take. How does horizontality cope with that problem?
Well, I guess I don't necessarily think of, another word for horizontality is democracy, right? So, I mean, I guess part of my approach to the whole game is to try and think about, maybe it's the spread of the digital, read-write digital literacies is a useful and interesting moment where it provides an opportunity for us to push on vertical movement structures, which maybe have dominated the social movement space for the last 20 or 30 years, perhaps, and say, if you really want to engage your base and actually build an effective and powerful social movement, you need to rethink the way that you organize. And part of it means including voices of your supposed participants or base rather than just producing the message yourself and spreading it out.
Yeah, no, I'm not defending that position. I'm just saying is that the answer to that
is...
It's not efficient.
It's not efficient. Right. You're not going to have clarity, and you're not going to have direction in the same way that you did before. And maybe that's something we live with, but...
Right. Well, part of that is, I mean, if you really pin me down on them, and I think it's sort of a first principles thing, which is like, I would say, you know, there are some things that are more valuable than efficiency, including in social movement spaces, and that ultimately, I do believe that it's more effective to organize in horizontal ways, because I think the problem with doing, you know, vertical movement building is that when the particular, you know, actor who's at the top of the pyramid disappears or gets co-opted or changes their mind or loses their funding, then the movement goes away. In other words, there's not really a movement there. There's just a well-funded, you know, actor, you know, producing messages and placing them in mass media. So I think that ultimately, you know, it's more successful. It's just not, you have to broaden your framework from, it's not going to be successful at maybe institutional stability or, you know, a particular, from the perspective of a particular organization, maybe it's a problem, but from the perspective of actually winning real broader victories that are going to be sustainable in the long run, I think it's key. Well, last question, Pablo.
Hi. One of the things that you said that was really interesting is how the social movement organization fits its communication strategy. And I wasn't sure if you were implying that those new transmedia communication strategies were pushing towards transforming the social movement's organization. So I wanted to know your thoughts on that. And also, if you had come across success stories in top-down organizations actually managing social media, I was thinking precisely on marketeers' advertising campaigns.
Yeah.
Because they managed in some degree to mobilize those social media to achieve their goals, which are, you know, really top-down.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And that's a great question. And then the section that I sort of skipped over at the end, which was the structure section, you know, have a number of examples of basically sort of, you know, battles between top-down and horizontalist organizers over how to deal with particular movement situations. And sort of I look at the sort of back and forth between them, and one of those questions is, does the new space push traditionally top-down organizations, you know, sort of more towards participatory strategy? And I think the answer is yes, and the ones that are smart are changing, but a lot of them aren't smart, and so they try and sort of cling. They're gonna cling to the death, to their old, you know, their old strategy. And I think it will be to the death because I don't think they'll be relevant, especially as the tools spread more and more widely, as the new generation, you know, comes up, and as more and more people, even those who are currently, you know, largely excluded from the digital spaces, are coming, you know, over time coming more and more online. I just think that. You know, it's going to be a real problem for those groups that try and, you know, cling to those strategies. The second part of the question, you can, as you're rightly pointing out, do transmedia strategy from a very top-down place. And so that's certainly what, you know, many marketers are doing in the Hollywood space. And that's where you have a small team of creatives who write the whole narrative, and then they, you know, systematically figure out how it's going to move across all these different spaces. But they do build in certain spaces of participation for the groups that they hope to become the fans and promoters. There's a wonderful, if you're interested in that, there's a great case study actually on Prezi.com. If you go look for transmedia blood, there was a TV series called Blood, which is about vampires, and there's a wonderful sort of expose of sort of the transmedia strategy that they used. They went on sort of goth boards and, you know, fans of vampires. They basically did this whole thing. They shipped them vials of, you know, fake vampire blood for like a year beforehand, and generated this whole sort of, you know, bottom up buzz, which then when they finally launched the series, it managed to sort of gain the largest viewing audience they'd ever had for that type of show. And it's all through a very carefully planned sort of top-down transmedia strategy, but it does include these elements of like, we're going to let the fans, I guess, participate in, not in writing some of the narrative of the TV series, but certainly in generating some of the backstory and the world that is inhabited by the series. So I think it's a longer conversation, but it's interesting to see how some of those strategies might work or not work in the movement space versus the marketing space. Thanks.